This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iran, diplomacy and the military option. Hello again, I'm Marvin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Iran is adamant about research that could lead to nuclear weapons, so Western Europe's no longer playing good cop to America's bad cop. But even if Russia and China go along, Iran says it'll retaliate against any sanctions the UN Security Council might impose. U.S. senators of both parties say the military option should be on the table. On To the Point, will Iran back down if it thinks the threat of attack is real? What diplomatic alternatives are not being explored? Have the Western nations picked a fight they can't win? A reporter's notebook letter on the mission to Pluto. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with To the Point. The U.S. and Europe faced a test of wills with Iran over research that could lead to nuclear weapons. On To the Point, are sanctions and military attack the only available options? Is this a fight the Western world is unlikely to win? On Reporter's Notebook, New Horizons, the spacecraft now scheduled for launch tomorrow on its way to Pluto. First, this news update. Sandra Day O'Connor may have written her last opinion as a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, she was author of that rare thing, a unanimous decision on an abortion case. Joan Biskupic is author of the new book, Sandra Day O'Connor, How the First Woman on the U.S. Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice. She reports on the court for USA Today. Joan, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
This was a parental notification law from New Hampshire. It had been overturned by a lower court. What did the court do today?
The justices essentially said, we need more information to decide whether this is constitutional or not. They said that even though New Hampshire didn't have an explicit exception for minors who might be facing health emergencies, a part of their law that might say, look, even though everybody's supposed to notify a parent within 48 hours of seeking an abortion, it said that, look, there were enough provisions in the law that might put that safeguard in. Let me try to parse that a little bit for you, Warren.
Sure.
New Hampshire's law said that any minor seeking an abortion had to tell a parent 48 hours in advance. And on the face of the law, it didn't have any exception for health emergencies. Now, the Supreme Court in the past has said you need a kind of exception for a health emergency. The way New Hampshire came back at that was to say, well, look, even though it isn't explicit, we have other provisions in our law that would allow a young woman facing a health emergency to get immediate help. And what the Supreme Court said today was, well, we just can't tell what the law says and what the legislative intent was here. So rather than try to make any kind of constitutional ruling on whether the New Hampshire law can stand, we're going to send this back to lower courts for two things. They said that lower courts should determine whether state legislators in New Hampshire had intended an exception for emergencies and in what situations the act might unconstitutionally interfere with the right to abortion. I realize that might all sound very confusing, but essentially what the court said was that the lower court judges had taken the most blunt approach by invalidating the entire statute here, and they said that judges should rule narrowly in these circumstances.
And as Justice O'Connor said in her opinion, we do not revisit our abortion precedents today. So by kicking this back to the lower court, they really didn't change anything.
That's right, Warren. But she did note that the court has long upheld state parental involvement statutes, but that it also has said that states may not restrict access to abortion needed to preserve the health of a mother, whether she be a teen or not. So you're right that while the court didn't move the line, it did at least reinforce that typically states can require parental involvement, but you always need to have an eye on the health of the mother.
Joan Biskupic again, Supreme Court reporter for USA Today. Now, of course, we have Samuel Alito apparently on the verge of being confirmed to Sandra Day O'Connor's seat. This, as I understand it, was the last day for decisions for quite a while and also the last day for arguments. So not only was this probably her last decision, but also the last time she got a chance to ask a question.
Right. This definitely was the last day for oral arguments. And, you know, Warren, she's been sitting there for 25 years asking questions in her usual piercing way. And that's over now, unless we have a very surprising turn of events with Samuel Alito. I should let you know that the justices will be back on Monday with an orders list and some opinions, but I think you're right to say that this is likely her last written opinion.
When you say, in subtitle of your book, that she became the most influential justice on the court, what can you tell us in 2 minutes that supports that very broad statement?
Well, I'll tell you, something that's relevant for today. She has been the swing vote on a divided court in cases involving abortion rights. She's been the swing vote on affirmative action in college admissions. You'll recall, Warren, the 2003 case at the University of Michigan where the justices narrowly, with one vote, Sandra Day O'Connor's, said that affirmative action can still take place in higher education. She's also been the key vote on questions of competent counsel for criminal defendants. So she's charted a course at the center of this bench, and she's not only been the swing vote, but she's also been the one who tends to craft the consensus language that lower courts then use to resolve similar disputes.
Hard to tell, really, from the answers that Judge Alito gave to the questions in the Senate, how he's going to be different. What's she been like personally? What's she like on the court? And what's it like to watch when she's engaged in questioning lawyers?
Well, that's a very good question, because she routinely puts forth the first query of these hour-long hearings, and she can be especially impatient with a lawyer who tries to sidestep her questions. She's not shy about asking some of the most basic details of the case or saying, look, if we rule the way you're asking us to rule, how will that affect lots of people out on the ground? She doesn't play devil's advocate. She doesn't try to telegraph to the other justices, arguments to persuade them. She more is in search of answers, and she's got a pretty distinct presence.
Okay. That's all the time we have. Joan Biskupic, thanks again, as always, with USA Today, author of Sandra Day O'Connor, How the First Woman on the Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice. In a moment, Iran, diplomacy, and the military option on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. In just 2 weeks, the International Atomic Energy Agency's Policy Board will meet in what's described as an extraordinary session to decide if Iran should be referred to the UN Security Council. Meantime, Israel is the latest nation asking Russia to approve in advance a package of sanctions if Iran continues the research program that could lead to nuclear weapons. Daphna Linzer is national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Daphna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
Pressure is being applied. No secret about that. The diplomats have referred to what they're doing as pressure on Iran, this extraordinary meeting being the latest example of it. Is it working?
Well, that's really an important question. I think you can see there is an enormous amount of diplomatic activity happening around the globe, I would say, today. We had President Bush speaking with his German counterpart, that's Angela Merkel. She met with the French Prime Minister today. Vice President Cheney is touring the Middle East. France, Britain, and Germany are circulating a draft resolution about trying to get Iran into the Security Council. As you mentioned, the Israelis are in Moscow. The French Foreign Minister is meeting with his Russian counterparts. Nick Burns, who is the top diplomat at the State Department, is in India trying to persuade the Indians to come on board with U.S. ambitions as far as bringing Iran to the Security Council. So there's an enormous amount of activity. I think for the United States and for its European allies, they are assured of enough votes in the IAEA to bring this issue to the Security Council. They want to do it with more support, as much support as they could possibly get among these 35 members of the board, as you discussed. And then, of course, the question is, what will happen next? And that's the big issue.
And, of course, we have then the issue of the Security Council veto, which Russia and China are able to exercise. So far, they do not seem to be on board. In the case of China, I think, either with regard to going to the UN or with sanctions, Russia, I guess, is okay with going to the board. Is that right? Or going to the Security Council?
Yeah, I think the position of Russia and China right now, as I understand it, and as it has been verbalized both to U.S. diplomats and to the Europeans, is that Russia and China do not want the issue to go to the Security Council.
Okay.
They do not want the Security Council involved. They will not block it from going to the Council, but they don't want a lot of activity once it gets there.
How much is the are the recent statements by the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, being used, saying that Israel should be wiped off the map, that the Holocaust is a myth, planning to have a session of some sort to reexamine the Holocaust? To what extent is that part of a diplomatic argument now?
I think it is enormously significant, far more significant than the Iranians calculated, if they even calculated at all, what the impact would be on those kinds of remarks. I think for the Europeans, you know, at the time, there was still a chance for Iran to sit back down at the table with Britain, France, and Germany. The Europeans just recoiled. They were horrified by the remarks, and none of them want to be seen as sitting down with a country whose president is making these kinds of remarks, casting doubt on the death of millions of Jews in World War II, and casting doubt on the validity of the state of Israel.
Are they arguing that if, in fact, Iran were to become a nuclear power, it might, in fact, use nuclear weapons?
You know, that's an interesting question. I haven't heard that issue raised at that kind of a policy level of whether or not Iran would use them. I think the issue is just preventing them from getting them in any case, either as a deterrent or for any other means. I think any country that has nuclear weapons becomes an extraordinarily powerful country, much harder to deal with, and I think they just don't want to see that happen. And I think with this kind of a president, and also with other Iranian leaders, but certainly with the current one, they just don't have the stomach for it.
In the meantime, we have Republican Senator McCain, Democratic Senator Schumer, and others talking about leaving the military option on the table, even if it's only a last resort. How seriously does the military option appear to be being considered by the Bush administration?
Well, as the president has said himself, he's been on the record as saying all options are on the table, but that he's using the diplomatic one. I think strategically or tactically, nobody can take the military option off the table, otherwise your hands are tied. But nobody, I think, both in the Pentagon and other places, no real military planners right now believe that it's something that they could exercise. It's certainly out there, but they cannot exercise it. And same with the Israelis. I think it would be very difficult for the Israelis at all to carry out an attack at this time. It's far away for Israel. It would be difficult for them militarily. And for the United States right now, with the situation in Iraq and in Afghanistan, it would also be difficult.
All right. Very difficult, very complicated situation now facing the world with regard to Iran. Again, there's no proof that it has in fact been engaged in military research. It insists that its nuclear program is entirely peaceful. Jack Straw, the foreign minister of Great Britain, has said it's now up to Iran. The onus is on Iran to prove that the program is exclusively peaceful. How could Iran do that?
There's a couple options out there on the table for Iran. I think one of the things that Iran could have done and has not fully done is to be a lot more transparent and cooperative with the IAEA, with the UN nuclear inspectors. I think if they were to be a little bit more transparent and more cooperative, I think that would be very, very helpful. There's a Russian offer on the table in which Iran would be able to enrich uranium to fuel its nuclear reactors, but it would do that enrichment in Russia, or at least not on Iranian soil. That way it would not also have a pathway to material it could use for a nuclear weapon. Those are some options out there on the table. The Iranians have rejected all of them and have not put forward other options that I think are acceptable to the Europeans or to the United States.
Daphne Linzer, as always, thanks for being on our program.
Thank you.
National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post. Mansour Farhang was the first ambassador to the UN of Iran's revolutionary government back in 1979. 1979 and 1980. Since then, he's left the country. He's now professor of political science at Bennington College in Vermont, a frequent guest in our program. Mr. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
How does this look from an Iranian point of view, and why isn't Iran engaged in more transparency? Why are they not accepting the Russian offer to enrich in that country or coming up with something of their own?
But as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has the right to have its own fuel cycle on its own territory. A number of other countries, such as Argentina, Brazil, Germany, Japan, and others, that enrich uranium and are members of the NPT. Here, the United States and European countries are asking Iran to do something that no other signatory to the NPT has been asked to do, that is, permanent and unconditional suspension of uranium enrichment, because Iran cannot be trusted. It's not a legal argument against Iran, but it's a question of trust, which has to be defined exactly what it means. Now, if there is validity, if there is legitimacy, particularly in the face of the remarks made by the president of Iran about Holocaust and Israel, if there is validity to this, and Iran, the pressures being applied to Iran must be balanced with incentives, that if Iran is going to give up its right to enrich uranium, then it has to get something in return. Here, the European states do not have the kind of incentives that would appeal to Iran. It is only the United States that has such power to deliver, to promise and deliver the kind of incentives that could change the nature of this confrontation. And so far, the Bush administration refuses to do that, and refusal of the Bush administration to engage in direct negotiation with Iran over these issues has persuaded the Iranian government that what the United States really wants is not an end to Iran's nuclear program, but it's a tactic to bring about regime change. Therefore, the confrontation continues, and even if it goes to the Security Council, it is very doubtful that the Security Council could come up with the kind of sanctions that would be acceptable to Russia, China, even the European states. I personally doubt that even the United States is particularly interested in imposing really biting economic sanctions, which means refusal to buy oil from Iran, a country which is the second oil-producing member of OPEC, 4.2 million barrels a day, and an end to that production could elevate the price of oil to probably $100 a gallon, which would be $100 a barrel, which would be just as awful for the American economy as Europe. Therefore, we are in a situation that we really need an innovative and imaginative initiative on the part of the United States, very much like what the Nixon administration did with respect to China. Short of that kind of innovative initiative on the part of the United States, we are not going to have much hope for a peaceful resolution of this conflict.
Let me ask you this before we get on to the question of possible incentives for Iran and whether or not the United States would be willing to grant such things. You mentioned the question of trust. Mohammed Al-Baradei, the head of the administrative head of the International Agency for Atomic Energy, has said that he has run out of patience with Iran because he believes that Iran has been not only overly secretive but in fact deceptive about its efforts, leading him to be suspicious, even though he has no evidence at this point, that they are in fact looking for the development of nuclear weapons. What about that? Doesn't Iran have to in some way bring him around before the United States would come around?
You see, all of these issues are really diversionary and beside the point. The undeniable truth is that any country that has the capacity to enrich uranium and has its own supply of raw uranium, as Iran does uranium mines, is potentially capable of enriching uranium to the level that it can use it for a bomb. Now, there is no question in my mind that the behavior of Iran in recent years, concealment, secret purchases of certain technologies and other things from Pakistan, China, North Korea, and others, convinces me that Iran wants to have what is called the surge option, which means it wants to have the technical capability, the technologies, the necessary material to put a bomb together if it is necessary, if it sees such a necessity at some point, depending on how it perceives a threat to its own survival. We are at such a point that right, which has to do with enrichment of uranium, has its own potential. It is the distrust of the regime, the nature of the regime is used in order to justify the distrust. And there is no way that Iran or any other country can prove to anybody, even if Iran was completely transparent, but permitted to enrich uranium on its own territory, Iran will still have the potential to enrich it to the level that would be used for a bomb.
Again, Mansour Farhang, once ambassador from Iran to the United Nations, now at Bennington College in Vermont. Let me go back to Daphna Linzer with the Washington Post, still with us, and thanks for staying on board. Iran is, it's often mentioned, surrounded by hostile forces, and or at least by countries that have nuclear capability, including Israel. Is there any appetite at all in Washington, not even in the Bush administration, then in Congress, for working out something of the sort that Mansour Farhang is talking about? We'll get more from him on that later, in terms of incentives, in terms of a way to try to defuse this controversy?
Yeah, I think that he raises some interesting points, which I'd like to address, specifically the one that you raised as well. I think he's right. I think at the very beginning, probably in the last about 2 years ago, the Bush administration was sort of questioning whether or not Iran did have this right to enrich uranium. I think they have come around to a point now where they've said publicly that they agree, yes, Iran does have the right to enrich uranium. It does have this legal right, but it is no longer trusted to exercise the right. I think that's sort of the question, and that is something, the word trust, which both Secretary Rice today used and the White House spokesman both specifically said, this is an issue of trust. And, of course, Farhan is right that, it's very hard to stop or to stop enriching at a certain level, and there's always the risk that you could get to bomb grade uranium, which is the issue here. I think as far as other countries having nuclear weapons, as you mentioned, the Israelis in the region and other Iranian neighbors, Pakistan, India, China, Russia is not that far away, all have nuclear weapons, and that's an issue. I think that that would be more of a valid argument if the Iranians were saying they did have a nuclear weapons program and that this was a question of regional balance. But because they're not saying that they have a nuclear weapons program and are insisting that they don't and that their program is just for nuclear energy, I'm not really sure how much validity that argument carries. I think the other issues, too, that were raised at the issue of this third option of the Iranians wanting to get to breakout capacity, I think that that is also the belief of U.S. intelligence, that the Iranians have not yet made the strategic decision to build a nuclear weapon, but are building a program that allows them to have that option in the future. That also questions whether or not their intentions are really solely for nuclear energy, or if they're using nuclear energy to get to a place where they could change their minds if they feel threatened. And regime change is, of course, always an issue.
Okay. Daphna Linzer, once again, with The Washington Post. We're going to take a very brief break, come back and talk with these guests and others in on our reporter's notebook. We'll talk about the fastest spacecraft ever launched, now scheduled to leave Earth tomorrow, New Horizons and its mission to Pluto. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about Iran, its nuclear research, whether in fact it is peaceful or designed for military purposes, or for the third option, which is to have the capacity just in case. As we heard described a moment ago, we'll get back to the question of what incentives might be offered Iran to change its policies. First, let me go to Reuel Marc-Gerecht, who's a former CIA officer in the Middle East, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, conservative organization, contributing editor to the Weekly Standard, and a contributing writer to the Atlantic Monthly as well. Always good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
Senator McCain has said that despite all of the various diplomatic issues we've heard about today, we have to keep the military option on the table. So has Senator Schumer of New York. So have others, just in case, and but only as a last resort. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a good idea. In fact, I would front load it a bit. I think by emphasizing last resort, you rob yourself a little bit of the value of diplomatic coercion. I think that needs to be up there very, very, very much in the foreground. In fact, the Europeans, and particularly the French, I think, were a little bit unsettled earlier on that the Americans actually forgot one of their primary roles in this process, which was to play the bad cop. When Condoleezza Rice made statements in September of last year saying this problem really wasn't that urgent, I think it took some Europeans aback, and they actually expected the Americans to be more aggressive here. They're not going to say that publicly, but privately they do. And the Bush administration so far, that may be changing now, hasn't been terribly forceful and certainly hasn't intimated to the Iranians that, you know, power politics, mach politique, is alive and well.
If, in fact, as we heard from Daphne Linzer, there are tactical problems and inability of either Israel or the United States to really take out Iran's nuclear forces, and no likelihood, it would appear, of international support for that, how is there diplomatic coercion then? Why should Iran believe this is possible?
Well, because I think Iran and the Europeans both believed it was possible in 2003. I mean, one of the reasons that the French and Germans embraced the EU3 approach was, in fact, fear that George W. Bush, you know, would display bellicosity against another a member of the Axis of Evil. I mean, I'm always deeply suspicious when people make arguments where technical arguments of whether you can do this or override will. I strongly suspect that if the United States made up its mind that if, in fact, they deemed Iran's nuclear weapons program to be intolerable, as President Bush has said many times, that we could develop a tactical plan. Remember, the United States isn't Israel. It is a superpower. Not only do you get to bomb one day, you get to bomb 2 days, you get to bomb as many days as you want, you get to come back as many times as you want. And the other thing that the Iranians have revealed in this entire process dealing with the EU3 is that certain facilities now appear to be more important than some people initially might have suspected. That there was a great concern before 2003 that the Iranians actually had a completely clandestine dual-track program, that they could duplicate everything they were doing openly someplace else. That's probably not the case now, and that in the case of Isfahan and Natanz, those facilities appear to be actually pretty critical to the overall nuclear program that the clerical regime has developed since 1989, 1990, when this became serious.
So that means then that you could hamper their program significantly by bombing a couple of sites? You wouldn't have to move in with troops or kill a lot of people in the process?
Well, no one's going to move in with troops. I mean, I think it is fair to say that any type of attack on these facilities, you will hit more, not less, that there are a lot of different facilities that you would like to hit. And if you think that the Iranians have, I think, been working on this fairly assiduously since 1989, 1990, when it really started in earnest. And by their own standards, I would describe this almost as a Manhattan Project. And if you think that they have come this far in that period of time, if you were to damage those facilities, if you were to destroy them, you would unquestionably retard the program. How much is open to debate, but it certainly would do damage to it.
Well, Mark Arecht, formerly with the CIA and now at the American Enterprise Institute, Weekly Standard, Atlantic Monthly. Dr. Jim Walsh is director of the Managing the Atom Project and a fellow in the International Security Program at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. Dr. Walsh, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
We have heard the word intolerable used by Ruel Marc Gerecht a moment ago in reference to what President Bush has said about the possibility that Iran would have the capacity to make a nuclear bomb. Is it intolerable to the extent that we ought to be ready to use military action to stop it?
Well, those are two different questions. On the issue of whether it's intolerable, I think any further spread of nuclear weapons is bad. It risks the use of those weapons in a region that has had conflict in the past. It would do damage to the nonproliferation regime. And the more states you have with nuclear weapons, the more likely you are to have nuclear war. On the other hand, I think there's a tendency for people to think that the moment that Iran were to get a nuclear weapon, on the second day they would use it. Or on the third day they would threaten someone or transfer it to a terrorist. And I think that's just exactly wrong. There's obvious danger in the proliferation of nuclear weapons, but it's not the sort of danger that people are thinking about. We have, unfortunately, had experience in this regard. China under Mao. No country was more of a rogue state than China under Mao. China said that it thought nuclear weapons were paper tigers, that it would be willing to fight and win a nuclear war, that it would give nuclear weapons to other countries. It wasn't in the UN. It wasn't in the NPT. Now, we didn't go and nuke them. We thought about it, but we didn't go and nuke them. And while I would prefer that China not have nuclear weapons, it hasn't meant the end of the world. So, again, it's something I've spent most of my professional career trying to reduce the dangers of nuclear weapons, but we ought to be clear about the type of danger we face. As for the a military attack, you know, I doubt very much whether I agree with Ruel that it would delay the program. But essentially, if they know how to build a centrifuge, they know how to build a centrifuge, and no amount of bombing is going to take that knowledge out of their heads. Moreover, there's the issue of cost. It's not like they're simply going to stand by and not do anything. They could play the oil card. They could make life much more miserable for us in Iraq if they chose to do so, given that long border between Iran and Iraq. But my chief concern about the military option, I understand it has to be used to sort of for diplomatic coercion. I get that. But if we were actually to implement that, it seems to me all that does is guarantee that Iran will become a nuclear weapon state in the future. Because experience shows the Osirak bombing by Israel against Iraq in 1981, other instances show that when you go and you bomb a country's nuclear plant, particularly a prideful or nationalist country like Iran, that just makes it a point of national pride, and no matter if the mullahs are overthrown or not, the next government that comes in, they're going to continue with the program. They'll become more determined than ever to finish a nuclear weapons program.
All right. Different views, obviously, on the issue of the military option and how likely it is or how possible it would be to be effective. Let me go back to Mansour Farhang again, first ambassador from the revolutionary government to the United Nations, now at Bennington College in Vermont. You said earlier that the United States must come up with some sort of imaginative ideas and proposals for incentives to get Iran to back away from what appears to be a very serious confrontation. What would they be?
If you begin with the assumption that Iranian pursuit of nuclear weapon capability is motivated by having a deterrent power and not for purpose of aggressive act against others, because the Iranian regime has committed many crimes against the Iranian people, but it has not committed any act of aggression against its neighbors. The Shah didn't, this regime didn't. In fact, I can say over the past nearly 300 years, Iran has not acted aggressively against its neighbors. If we begin with that assumption, then Iran, even an untrustworthy state, could have legitimate concerns. What are the Iranian legitimate concerns? Iran is surrounded by American military presence, ring of American military presence in Iran, in the Persian Gulf and Turkey, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And Iran is convinced that the United States wants to make permanent military bases in Afghanistan and Iraq close to Iranian borders. Therefore, there is a deep sense of fear and insecurity, which was much more intense before the United States got stuck in Iraq, before the quagmire in Iraq, but still remains. And then the threat that regime change is the objective of the United States and the axis of evil and the rest. Therefore, security guarantee, even the possibility of a non-aggression pact between Iran and the United States, could be a very significant security incentive for Iran. Second, the United States has imposed economic sanctions on Iran over the past 27 years. The sanctions have not really influenced the Iranian behavior, and the Iranian market today is packed with American goods, consumer goods, going through third countries. Sanctions have been ineffective. The United States could lift these sanctions, because nevertheless the sanctions have hurt the Iranian economy in the sense that it makes it very difficult for them to attract international capital or even engage in joint long-term productive investment.
All right, let's go back to Reuel Marc Gerecht on these two issues, a security guarantee and the lifting of economic sanctions. Why not if Iran then, presumably, one would assume, I'll get back to Ambassador Farhang, but assume we see more transparency and guarantees of peaceful use of the nuclear materials?
Well, I mean, I think that's not going to happen now. If nothing else, Ahmadinejad has sort of guaranteed that the United States, and I would say absolutely, there is within the Department of State, which is now the lead agency on Iran policy, there has always been this very strong, what you might say, realist disposition that they would like to find some grand bargain. That's not going to happen now. I mean, and the Europeans also know that's not going to happen now.
Why not?
Because you're simply not going to engage in appeasement with a regime like that, with someone like Ahmadinejad. It's just not going to happen.
When does it become appeasement as opposed to working out a compromise with a government, as Ambassador Farhang described it, which may not be trustworthy, but which can be at least relied upon to act in its own interest?
Well, I'm saying that what the interests, I mean, what you're trying to set up is a scenario where, in fact, the clerical regime is sort of a rationalist model that is not ideologically driven. I mean, it has been engaged in a lot of nefarious activity for a very, very long time and has obviously concealed its nuclear research program, which all the EU3 members of the United States have no illusion is designed to produce nuclear weapons. I find it very, very unlikely that you have any appetite now. It might have been possible, actually, under Mohammad Khatami, even though his government was very much involved in accelerating and ensuring this program moved forward, that it might have been possible then because, you might say, the cosmetics would have allowed you to go farther. Ahmadinejad has in fact, stopped that. So I don't think you're going to find George W. Bush, in fact, engaging in incentives, and I think the dictionary definition of that is appeasement. With this regime, you're not going to find them come forward and say,
okay,
all right, I'm going to give you billions of dollars if you hereby promise not to develop nuclear weapons. And we're certainly not going to go to the Iranians and say, oh, by the way, I guarantee you that nothing that happens in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Central Asia you're going to find offensive. We're going to withdraw our troops, and we hereby promise that under no circumstances to threaten you. I think the clerical regime would find that a bit odd.
Back to Dr. Jim Walsh at Harvard. Do you agree with Reuel Marc Gerecht, or do you think that there are still openings for the kind of diplomatic overtures that Mansour Farhang suggests? Is it politically possible at this point for the Bush administration to even bring that up?
Well, I agree with the ambassador that that's the better strategic plan. At least there's an end game there, and there's a logic to it. But I'm afraid I agree with Reuel that that does not seem likely. I'm afraid, and I'm not one that believes in inevitability. There's always possibilities. But this it looks like the train has left the station on this one. The Iranian-U.S. relationship has been a complicated one over the decades in which, at different times, the U.S. has made extended an olive branch only to be repulsed by the Iranians and vice versa. We never can seem to get our act together all on the same page at the same time. And now, I think, as Reuel rightly points out, there's a harder line position in Iran. Now, how much power does Ahmadinejad actually have? That's, I think, a real question. But in any case, as the face of the regime, it's going to be difficult to make that work. And frankly, positions have hardened here in the U.S. too. So this is one of those cases where hardliners tend to reinforce each other. Now, I'm afraid I'm somewhat pessimistic. El Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said this week that his sort of deadline, working deadline for this is March 6th. If we get to March and things start to escalate, it's given to the Security Council at the UN and there are sanctions and Iran responds and we go up the escalatory ladder politically, maybe there'll be an opening to prevent things from just blowing apart, either literally or metaphorically. But right now, it's hard to imagine either side cozying up with the other and talking about normal relations or incentives or compromises.
We have very few moments left in this program, and I want to ask all three of you, if I can, as briefly as possible, perhaps within 30 seconds or so, to tell us what do you think is most likely now? First, Mansour Farhang, go ahead.
But most likely now is the issue, but will probably go to the Security Council, and in the beginning they pass some resolutions which will not have any significant impact on Iran, because they will not have bite, because Russia and China will not agree to serious economic sanctions. And therefore, the stalemate will continue. But one point I want to make, that what Ahmadinejad said about Israel was absolutely stupid, bigoted, and the vast majority of Iranians are embarrassed that the man who carries the name of the president could say such idiotic things. And yet I wish to remind the listeners that when President Bush says he receives order from God and he is carrying out God's instructions in the Middle East, American or Europeans might reject it as silly talk, but the vast majority of Muslims, particularly in the Middle East, relate to this type of statement as an imperialist rationale for aggression and domination. So theological thinking in foreign policy is not limited to Tehran. It is also in Washington.
Reuel Marc-Gerecht, what do you think is going to happen in the next months?
Well, I think they are going to give this to the Security Council. If any type of sanctions regime comes out of there, it's probably going to be fairly tepid. What the United States would want to do, if it's going to have any bite, is sort of replicate what Great Britain did in 1952 or 53, which essentially brought about some type of oil embargo and collapsed the internal support for Mr. Mossadegh, which is why the coup was so easy in 53. That's very unlikely to happen. I think most likely the Americans will then go to the Europeans and see if, in fact, together they can develop a serious sanction regime, or if, in fact, it allows the United States only the unilateral option, which means the possibility of a military strike becomes greater.
Dr. Walsh, sorry we're running short of time, but I do want to give you an opportunity to answer that question if you can.
Well, and briefly, I think it may go to the Security Council. We might have political but not economic sanctions. We might also just give the IAEA more mandate, a broader and deeper mandate to continue its investigations. That's something being talked about within the agency. And the Russians are still in play here, even though the Iranians have dismiss this, please, enrich in Russia and we'll send you the fuel and we're done. I think if things get really, really bad, folks will be hunting around for options to avoid a complete political meltdown and perhaps the use of force. So there still may be some options left.
Thanks to you all, Dr. Jim Walsh at Harvard, Will Marc-Gerecht, American Enterprise Institute, Mansoor Farhang at Bennington College. Good to have you. And thanks also to Daphne Linsner, our earlier guest from The Washington Post. First high winds, now an unresolved power outage, have delayed the launch of New Horizons, which will go where no spacecraft has gone before, to Pluto, which is either a planet or a part of the Kuiper Belt, thought to be debris from creation of the solar system. In a moment, more on the frontier of planetary science on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the Point, all one word, .com.
Herman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. New Horizons is now scheduled for launch tomorrow. When it gets going, it'll be the fastest spacecraft ever, traveling at 47,000 miles an hour, powered in part by 24 pounds of plutonium. Even at that rate, it'll take 10 years to travel 3 billion miles to the vicinity of Pluto. Richard Binzel is professor of planetary science at MIT and a New Horizons science team member, joins us from Cape Canaveral. Professor, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Good afternoon.
How's the launch going now?
Well, we have a stand down for the day while the ice storms in the northeast play themselves out, and we're back to full power in our spacecraft control center in Maryland.
You optimistic that it'll get off tomorrow?
Certainly. Things look, in terms of everything at the Cape and the rocket, everything's looking very good here.
Why do we want to know about Pluto and its immediate vicinity?
Well, the outer solar system is a place where the original material that formed all of the planets, including the Earth, and including all the materials that make life on Earth possible, it's a region where all of that material has been kept in deep freeze over the last 4.5 billion years. And so in many ways, going out and seeing what we find at Pluto and beyond is not just a journey in space, it's also a journey back in time to seeing the original matter that makes Earth and that makes us.
Considering the distances involved and the time factor, what exactly is New Horizons going to be able to tell us? I presume it's not going to land on Pluto and scoop up a little bit of soil and fly back.
This New Horizons is a flyby mission of Pluto. It will take 9 years from its launch to reach Pluto, so patience is required. We have a long-range imaging camera system that will begin about 2 or 3 months out before we get to Pluto, and we'll be mapping with continually better resolution day by day until finally we'll see the planet Pluto with details as small as 50 meters across.
And what will that teach us?
Well, we want to know how Pluto puts itself together. How does nature operate in these amazingly cold environments? This is minus 450 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, things we take for granted, nitrogen, which fills the atmosphere of the Earth, it's so cold at Pluto, nitrogen is frozen solid. And we want to know how nature operates, because the more we understand how nature operates in that kind of environment, it helps feedback and confirm to know even how the Earth works.
How much of the information that you anticipate will have some sort of practical utilitarian value? How much of it is pure satisfaction of curiosity? Curiosity, I should say, obviously, that goes back to the beginnings of a human experience.
That's right. Some of the basic questions of who we are and how we got here are just fundamental to human nature. Others, I think it's just a better understanding of the way planets work. Certainly has feedbacks to us, whether it's in greenhouse gases or warming trends and things like that. How atmospheres work, how things work in different environments, I think is a certain help to Earth. But I think in large measure it's the human urge to explore. This is the far frontier of the solar system. And human imagination is always about getting to that next furthest frontier.
Talking with Professor Richard Binzel, of MIT with the science team for New Horizons. What about the use of plutonium to help the spacecraft get up to that extraordinary speed of 47,000 miles per hour? There's been a lot of controversy about that, based mainly on the fear that if something goes wrong and it falls back into the atmosphere, then plutonium, one of the most, or if not the most toxic material on Earth, will be spread around in the atmosphere.
Well, we need the radioactive material to provide electrical power at Pluto. It's too far away to use solar power. So all of the thrust and everything that gets us to Pluto is all conventional rockets. This is an Atlas rocket that has been flying since of a generation has been flying since 1960 or so, and so this is a very safe launch vehicle. There's only a very extreme. There has to be this amazing extreme set of really bad things to happen before any radiation or any material is even possibly released. And even at that, as long as you don't pick it up and eat it, the exposure risk is incredibly low. It's about getting an extra X-ray or so. So this has gone through all of the very rigorous approval that has to come through the Environmental Protection Agency. And we've put safety first and followed everything to the letter. And we're all quite confident this is a safe and sensible thing to do.
Back to the question about launching, it's my understanding that the window closes on February 4th, and if it can't get off the ground by that time, it won't be able to rendezvous with Jupiter for another 5 years. Tell us a bit about that rendezvous with Jupiter. What's that about?
So if we can get off, and I think it's February 2nd or so, or early February, if we get off the pad en route to Jupiter, then Jupiter can give us a gravitational boost and speed ourselves along to Pluto, and that will allow us to get there in 2015. If we go later than, I think, about February 2nd, then we have to go direct to Pluto. And without that boost from Jupiter, it adds another anywhere from 3 to 5 years to our flight plan. So we're very hopeful. We're certainly planning on making use of Jupiter and getting us to Pluto a bit faster, and it's just a good idea for the health of the spacecraft and on those kind of timescales, even the health of the scientists who know how to fly it.
That's certainly an issue. It's going to be a long time before any information comes back. What do you do, and what do the others involved in this project do for the next 9 years while New Horizons is on its way to Pluto?
This New Horizons is an interesting mission where a lot of us started on us very young, even as students just fresh out of graduate school. So a lot of us have been involved with this very early in our careers. But all of us have different day jobs, if you will. I have my job as a professor. And so you have many people who have university jobs or other NASA research jobs. And so New Horizons for the next 9 years will just be a piece of the ongoing activities that we're involved in.
When it is out there, presuming it does make its rendezvous with Pluto, how long will it take for signals to get back and forth?
From Pluto back to the Earth, it's a four-hour trip. And so if we want to give a command to a spacecraft and then wait to see if it did it, it's 4 hours there and 4 hours back. So obviously everything we do is is pre-programmed long in advance of when we want the spacecraft to execute a maneuver.
A lot of nail-biting, though, is going to go on, one would assume, increasing as it gets closer and closer to its goal.
That's right. At some point you get used to that kind of delay. In going out to Saturn, where we have the Cassini spacecraft, it's a little over 1 hour out and 1 hour back. So it's something that's quite common in the business, and you begin to think in those kind of timescales.
Just a couple of seconds left, but do you think this will resolve, presuming the experiment works as it should, whether or not Pluto is a planet, in fact?
All of the science questions that we ask about Pluto are planet-like questions. For example, we want to know about its surface, what it's made of. We want to know about its atmosphere. We want to know about its moon. We want to know about its seasons. And these are the same kind of questions that we ask, for example, about Mars. And so from a scientific point of view, Pluto and everything about Pluto is very planet-like.
Well, good luck. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Richard Binzel at MIT and a science team member on New Horizons. Today's program produced by Sharon Rembaum with Katie Cooper and Christian Bordahl. Technical director Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.